now more than ever, people need to go within and plug into that cellular memory, plug into divine source, detach as much as possible from the matrix. Hello again, everybody. This is James Bartley, and you're watching and listening to the Cosmic Switchboard Show. Today, our special guest is Steve LaPlume. Steve is the author of From Rendlesham to Redemption. Steve has had a varied and interesting career. He was in the Air Force, and he was at RAF Bentwaters when a lot of the incidents and events transpired. I've had Larry Warren on the show in the recent past, and he talked about his experiences, and Larry and Steve know each other quite well. So without any further ado, Steve, welcome to the Cosmic Switchboard Show.
Oh, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
The honor and privilege is all ours, Steve. I don't have the benefit, like I said at the outset, before we got started, of having read your book. It's probably in transit at the moment. So for the benefit of our listeners and viewers, I've always been interested in, you know, the origin stories, the voyage of discovery, if you will, that each one of our guests has undergone to get to this point. So if you don't mind, to tell us a bit about your background and how you came to be involved in all these experiences.
Yeah, sure. Well, originally, I'm just a real quiet, kickback kind of kid. My dad was a cop, so I was kind of ostracized a lot. And when growing up in the 60s and 70s, my dad was the fuzz. He was the man. So I was always kind of a fly in the wall type of kid anyways. And I wanted to actually get into nursing. I worked in a nursing home when I was 16 and thought that was kind of a cool career path. So I was kind of, my whole high school career was geared towards being a licensed practical nurse with maybe further on, you know, getting a little more education, becoming an RN. And a lot of that had to do with my father was a med tech in the Air Force. So growing up, I just used to read all his medical manuals. I mean, when I was in the seventh, eighth grade, I already had the elementary canal memorized and, you know, different chambers of the heart. It was just interesting to me, you know. So I was gearing up for that. And then it was during kind of the same situation we're in now economically in the 70s with Jimmy Carter and the fuel situation. And this school ended up closing down due to budget cuts. So I no longer had a nursing school to go to. And it was my senior year. And I was kind of like, all right, well, there goes all my plans for life for the next few years. Well, now what am I going to do? So I just sat around. I thought, well, maybe I'll go ahead and go in the military for a few years and kick around and figure out what I'm going to do with my life. Went down and talked to the recruiter and figured I'd be in the Air Force. That's what my father was in. Like I said, he was a med tech, and he used to fly like from Vietnam, from Da Nang. He'd pick up wounded and go to Norton Air Force Base in California and drop them off. You know, during the war, he did that. And he stayed active. Gosh, I think he was in the military like 35 years or something. He was in there forever since World War II. He joined when he was 16 in World War II. He lied about his age. So I went in and I thought maybe I'd go into the medical field. But then my father, when he was in the reserves, he was a police officer. And then he'd go fly missions on the weekends, you know, with the Air Force. So I got there and I figured out, well, why not be a cop? And follow my dad's footsteps, make him proud, you know, that sort of thing. And I didn't like the police officer part, but I kind of liked the security part a little better, because at the time there was security police, which was SP, then there was LE, law enforcement, and they were two separate entities. And I believe they combined them now. So I went into the Air Force as a new recruit, actually on the delayed enlistment program. So I signed up in the fall of, let me think, that would have been 1979. And I started accumulating time served. So when I got out of basic training, I already had two stripes on my arm that I really didn't deserve, because all I did was sit out time. But they were having trouble recruiting people. It was 1979. Vietnam just got over. I mean, they weren't having a whole lot of luck in people in the service. So they were given incentives. So I actually signed up for 6 years, got two stripes, and ended up in RAF Bentwaters. That was my choice, actually, was the United Kingdom. And actually, I put England. And kind of funny story, when we all went into this one room and they said, okay, everybody, here's your assignments, and this is where you're going to be posted next. So after the academy, you know, the police academy, I looked at my assignment and I'm thinking, Unken, where the heck is Unken? I've never heard of Unken. Is that like some small island in the Pacific? Where in the world am I going? So I went up to the sergeant. I said, excuse me, sir. I said, or sergeant, you know, call him sir. Said, excuse me, sergeant. I don't understand. Where's Unkin? And he kind of looked at me like, wow, what kind of dumbass are you? He goes, it's the United Kingdom. You're going to England. I'm like, oh, okay. So anyways, just being young and stupid. So I got there in November of 1980 and checked in, did all my training and everything. And I never had a security clearance come through. So I couldn't work with the security police. So I was temporarily assigned to the law enforcement. And because I didn't have any law enforcement training, I wasn't much use to them, but I didn't need a security clearance to drive around and give bathroom breaks and lunch breaks, which is pretty much all I did the first month or so I was there. And we let me back up. The Eastgate, you know, the infamous Eastgate, you know, Larry Warren's book, Left at Eastgate, that closed about 7 o'clock at night every night. So after seven, we would go and occasionally check and make sure that that gate was closed and nobody tried to breach it and the lock was locked and all that. So we went over there and checked it, and we had heard that there was a UFO incident, I don't know, 3, 4 weeks earlier. And we heard about it for a day or two, maybe a week, and then it got brushed under the rug. And that's what Larry was involved with. And that was in December of 1980. So about 4 weeks later is when I had my incident. And the only reason I even injected myself in this whole case, because I think this case is a mess with people's egos and everything else involved, but was there was a question of, did the officers know what was going on? Did they know it was a UFO? You know, did anybody have any inside information? So when the officers came, when we reported what we saw, and I'll get into what I saw in a minute, but when the officers came, they were as blind and dumbfounded and curious as the rest of us. And I honestly, maybe after the fact, they got read into something and got some information on the inside, but I really don't think they had any idea what was going on. Not the night I met them, anyways. Not the night they came out and responded to my incident. So that's my only, I think, positive input on this whole case was the disposition of the officers. Other than that, I just had a sighting that was completely separate from everybody else's. So,
That was
but
at
the site.
the left, the just to interject for a second, that was at the Eastgate area.
Yeah, that was at the East Gate. Yep. Like I said, we go and check it out every now and then. And we went and checked it out, and the gate was locked. Okay. I went back to the cruiser, and we were talking. I was talking with my partner, Senior Airman Palmer. And it was kind of a cool night. We had nothing to do. You know, like I said, we just drive around, and I'd give people breaks so they could go to the bathroom or go get something to eat at the chow hall. And when the gate opened up in the morning, I'd get posted on the gate for an hour or so until it was time to head back. And then we would just sit around talking, and Palmer brought up, oh yeah, you know, there's the lighthouse over there, and somewhere over in that forest is where these guys got chased by a UFO. And I was like, oh yeah, I heard something about that. I was in the day room when these guys came in off duty from, you know, that night. And he was like, yeah. And we started talking, and I looked up in the sky kind of over his shoulder because we were facing each other, talking to each other over the hood of the cruiser. And I was looking at him. I said, hey, check that out. And you know, like you just see a satellite in the sky and it's just kind of real cruising along real slow. And you know, it's a satellite. Well, this thing was cruising along, but it started going like up and down like this. Let me see how I can do how fast it was going up and down. Up and down, up and down, up. I mean, it was just, it looked like a heartbeat monitor that was kind of freaking out, you know? And the elevation it was going with, thousands of feet up and down in elevation. So it couldn't have been a helicopter. It couldn't have been a plane. You know, I mean, they would have had to, you know, dive down and then dive back up. There's no way it could have gone up and down at the angle it was doing. And then we watched it for a couple of minutes and went behind a cloud. Palmer called it in, and as soon as he called it in, and he actually kind of threw me under the bus, he called in on the radio and said, hey, LaPlume just saw a UFO. He didn't mention himself, you know. So the guard shack that we had, the phone rang. My duty officer, Officer Englund, he contacted me, and he said, hey, what'd you see? We told him, hey, it just went behind a cloud, but the cloud was over the forest. So I said, it went behind a cloud over the forest. And because I said the forest, I guess that triggered the fact of what happened in the forest, weeks earlier. So all of a sudden, I think within 15, 20 minutes, there were officers coming from all directions at us. And Colonel Halt showed up first, and he asked what we saw. A couple of the people showed up. Somebody showed up with a night vision scope. I believe that was Lieutenant England. And there was another person that showed up whose wife was a real UFO enthusiast. And I got this information here about a year ago from Colonel Halt. Apparently, I thought that maybe it was the deputy base commander and his wife, but it turns out it was somebody like in transportation department and his wife, because his wife was a UFO nut. She really wanted to see one. So she was there, and it was kind of weird. There were civilians there. She brought her son, and there were some officers, and they all jumped in a station wagon and went out to the forest, which didn't make much sense because it was up in the sky. I don't know why they went out into the forest. But again, we didn't know what happened in the forest weeks earlier. So that's why we just didn't understand what was going on. And then they came back out of the forest about maybe 30, 40 minutes later, posted me on the gate all night long and said, stay here. And they all took off. So I was left alone at the gate. Palmer went out and did what he does. He was kind of the shift supervisor. He came back an hour or so later, and we were talking again. And then, when you're standing there at that gate, you figure out that's the approach for all the aircraft. So you know that they're coming in at a certain angle all the time, where they're coming in off the North Sea. And this one aircraft was coming in, but he was a little to the right of the runway where he should have been. So Palmer and I are looking at it, and I probably mentioned something like, hey, look at that. And we were looking at it. And then from that point on, I don't remember Palmer saying anything, and it was like my hearing got shut off. And when that craft came over the forest, like I said, it was to the right of the runway, so it was actually coming up the access road to the gate. And it seemed kind of like cylindrical, and it had like a bit of a fog around it. And then there's a period where it was halfway up the road, and then the next thing I know, it was over my head. And I mean, it could have been the blink of an eye, and it was over my head. And it was a structured craft. It had metal and stuff underneath it. It had some sort of a square. I call it a hatch, but I don't know what it was, but had like this square inside of a square inside of a square type of a, again, I can only equate it as a hatch. I don't know exactly what it was, but that's what my mind is saying it was. And then the next thing I knew, it was, and I probably watched it for 5, 10 seconds. Next thing I know, it was to my right, and it slowly was heading off. But when it was to my right and taken off, it was already kind of a ball of light at that point and taken off up into the sky. I don't remember it being any sort of shape other than a bright light. And it slowly ascended up into the stars, and I couldn't tell it from a star. And as soon as I realized, okay, it's gone, I looked at Palmer, and Palmer looked at me, and he said, you want to call that one in? And I said, hell no. And we never called that in at all. We just kept that a secret. And never mentioned it to anybody. We probably should have. I mean, in hindsight, we should have. But I'm sorry, my phone's falling. So that was my big sighting. And after that, it seemed like my world kind of collapsed. Right? I mean, I just turned 18. I was kind of a mama's boy, like I said. I was very much an introvert, and I just kind of felt like, wow. Everybody in the world lying to me here? I just saw a UFO. These things aren't supposed to exist. So it kind of threw me up in the head. It kind of messed with me a little bit. And then Larry came in a week or so later and talked to me, and he told me what happened to him. And he told me about them taking him in an underground base and being interrogated and sodium pentothal and all this stuff. And I was just like, whoa, this is a little too much for me. I was really starting to be concerned for my well-being, And one day I decided, okay, I think I need to get off this base. And the reason I decided that was I noticed a couple people following me. And I'm not a stupid man. I've got a fairly high IQ. So I kind of did a few things here and there and made sure I was actually being followed. And for sure, these guys were following me. Over a couple of days, I caught them tailing me. And one day I went into the all ranks club, and they were sitting in there, like they were sitting in there waiting for me, but they were sitting in the all ranks club. And when one went to the bathroom, I approached the other one, and before I did that, I got a cigarette from the barmaid, and she told me that they were not speaking any English, that they were speaking German. So I went up and I had the cigarette in my hand, and I said, "Hey, you got a light?" And the guy looked at me like he didn't speak English. So I just, kind of like a Bic lighter, "Hey, a light." "Oh yeah, okay." So he lit my cigarette, and I took a puff, and then I just kind of put it out. I said, "Listen, I don't even smoke. I said, I'm just here to let you know you guys are horrible tails. I'm on to you. You might as well stop." And then I turned around and walked away, which is very out of character for me. And I don't know what we're allowed to say on your podcast here, but I think,
Profanity is fine.
okay, well, this isn't really too profane, but I consider that the point where I became a man and my balls dropped, because it was not in my character to approach anybody. I wasn't a tough guy back then, and I was actually hoping the service would kind of toughen me up a little bit, And when I went in the service, I was 6 foot one, 143 pounds, soaking wet. I was just a skinny geek, band geek, basically, So I went over and I went to get something to eat. When his partner came back from the bathroom, they said something, and instead of getting up and leaving out the front door like everybody should, they went out the back door, and nobody leaves out the back door. It's just an alley. So I was like, "Well, that's awful weird. Why would two guys that are TDY from Germany be going out the back door? That doesn't make sense." So I went over to the back door after it closed, and I had my hand on the handle, and I remember kind of like being on the balls of my feet, getting ready to fight. And I was ready to get into it with these guys, and I was like, "Well, I'm not just going to open it. I'm just going to slowly peek." And so I put the handle down, and I kind of peeked out, and I saw a Lincoln Town Car with New York plates, and it was a Lincoln Mark IV, and I remember that distinctly because my uncle had one of those cars. And it was driving away, and I saw its brake lights, and I thought, how would somebody from TDY from Germany be in a Lincoln Town Car with New York plates? Which people bring their cars over from the States, and they would, if they stayed on the base, they could keep the US plates, but if they were going to go off base, I guess they had to get, UK plates. I never had to deal with that, so I'm really not sure how that worked. But Larry had mentioned a dark car and him getting pulled into it, and this was a dark Lincoln Town Car. So I thought, yeah, this is just a little too much for me. I need to get out of here. So I came up with a scheme of how I should get out of there. And one day I drank a half a bottle of vodka and went into the all ranks club. And I was thinking, man, I got to get out of here. I got to get out of here. And I was pretty drunk. And I heard the theme song for MASH, which, if you ever listen to the words, it's actually suicide is painless. And I thought, ah, I'm going to pull a clinger. So I went back to the barracks, cut my stomach open with a knife. And actually, the knife wasn't real sharp, so I used a razor out of my shaving kit, cut my stomach open a bit, and turned myself in for a suicide attempt. And one thing led to another. I got chased around the base for a while. I just didn't want to give up easily. And that was kind of the end of my career at that point. I went and got a mental health evaluation. And they said, "Okay, you're going to take a series of tests." I looked at the test and I kind of read forward a little bit, and I'm like, "Okay, I see what they're looking for." And can I say something without really trying to brag?
Yes, please.
I got tested in the fifth grade, and because they thought I was kind of a moron, I guess. I don't know. My grades were really bad at school, and they pulled me out of class one day because they gave us a in fifth grade they gave us this English composition thing we had to do. I had to write an essay. And we could write an essay, I think, about just about anything. So I wrote like a 3-page dissertation on the symbiotic relationship between student and teacher and all this stuff. And so anyway, so they pulled me out of class and they gave me an IQ test, and I popped a 153 IQ in the fifth grade. So and my grades still continued to be horrible. I hated school. I was smarter than the teachers. I was bored to death, and I don't know, it was just so unstimulating. I couldn't stand it. I couldn't wait to get out of school, So anyway, so when I the reason I'm saying that is when I read these battery tests they were going to give me, I read ahead and I figured, okay, I know how to answer these tests to get out of here. So I was a loner. I was depressed. I answered every question negative that I could the way they wanted. Thought I was done because it took forever to do this big test. Signal the testee. Oh, I'm sorry, the tester. I guess I was the testee, huh? little pun there. And the lady came over, she took my test, and then she said, "Here's the second part." And I was like, "Oh my God." So So when she wasn't looking, I read ahead on that, and I was, oh, it's the same question, but they're asking them a different way. So I guess they try to catch in a lie that way. So I just answered those questions in the same way. And a little while later, a few days later, I got called in, and the clinic shrink said, "What do you want to do?" And I said, "I want to get out of the Air Force. I want to get off this base as soon as possible." He said, "Okay." He said, "I can do that for you." I said, "Really?" He goes, "Yeah." He goes, "I'll just write up, excuse me, I've got a kitty cat here. I'll just write up that you're immature and you don't belong in the service and you can get out and it won't affect you in civilian life that much. And, you know, it's not a dishonorable discharge. You just fail you to adapt." I went, "All right, that works for me." So he started that going. And in the meantime, I called my father and let him know what was going on because, again, he was an Air Force veteran. And, he made a few political phone calls. He knew Tip O'Neill. He was the Speaker of the House at the time. And my congressman, my dad, and my uncle were involved in politics a little bit, mostly my uncle. So he went through him. So I had two congressional inquiries about what was going on. And that's kind of a big deal when somebody from Congress gets in touch with your commander and says, "You need to let me know what's going on with this soldier or airman, you know." So they got two of them on the same day. So I ended up getting an honorable discharge. And I got my benefits, which I don't even use, just because I don't think I deserve them. I go once a year and get a physical. That's it. And got out and really went downhill and started getting to drinking and drugs quite a bit. I mean, it was the 80s at that point. There was a lot of cocaine going on, and like being a soldier, just didn't like being in the situation I was in. So I saw ad for a mercenary school down in Alabama and went down there and got some training. And after a couple of years, somebody pulled me aside and said, "Hey, we got something going on." And one thing leads to another, and you find yourself somewhere with a gun in your hand. So that's what I did.
You know, just to interject
But
real
I was
quick.
always very
Oh,
adventurous
please.
after that. I just kind of gave up on everything and just said, you know, F everything, screw everybody. My attitude was just not healthy at all. Very self-destructive attitude. Wouldn't mind trying. What do you got for drugs? Yeah, let me try it. I'll try anything. You know, I mean, that sort of that attitude, just real self-destructive. Didn't care about anything. So, kind of lost my moral base there for a while. So, you know, and then when I started soldiering and doing that stuff, I consider those 5 years the time I wasn't human, because if you're going to be in a war zone, you got to lose your morals and your everything and just go animal. Or if you're not going to make it otherwise, you know. I think that's why a lot of people have PTSD. They try to keep their worldly viewpoint when they're in a unworldly situation like that, you know. So, anyways, that's my two cents.
Oh, just a quick comment and a question. One of the themes that comes up, small sample size to be sure, but I'm sure probably others felt the same way. You've just mentioned it. Lori Rehfeld talked about it, and Larry talked about it. This overwhelming desire to get off that base. It was as if there was something about that base was that was literally anathema to you guys, and considering all the stuff that had gone on, right? And also, did you ever have any dreams in the months and years after that close sighting when that cylindrical craft was right above your head? Anything UFO related? Nothing?
I didn't have any dreams about that craft at all, but I had a dream that reoccurred, and it was just twice I had this dream, but it was the exact same dream, and it was so real. I've never had a dream that real ever in my life. And what it was, and it's kind of embarrassing, the dream actually, but I had a dream that I died. And like in my dream, all of a sudden I was aware that I was dead, and everything was super bright light, warm. It was the most peaceful, beautiful dream I've ever started off at. And I remember ascending up thinking, "Wow, I'm going to heaven. I'm going to meet Jesus. I think I died," you know, type thing. And I get up further up, and I remember all of a sudden I was laying on my back, and this is the embarrassing part, and I was getting probed anally. And I remember thinking, "You're not God, you're the devil." And I woke up, and I had that dream twice. And I got to tell you, it was so freaking real. It was I don't know how to describe it. When I woke up, I was just beside myself, like, oh my God, am I flashing back? Did I get abducted? Did I just get taken? It was so weird. It freaked me out for days. I mean, literally, just it was a mind blower. So, but other
Yeah,
than that,
because I was curious about that because well, clinical question, did you ever feel any rectal discomfort after those dreams or any body memory of saying?
No, I like I said, I never had a dream. I've had more dreams about combat and other stuff than I ever had about that. I mean, that, to put into context, I mean, that was one night of my life, and that was just a few hours compared to so much other stuff I've done and so much junk I've thrown in my brain and my psyche. I mean, I got PTSD from, I was over in Thailand when the tsunami hit, and yeah, I mean, that, I can't even talk about that. But,
I remember when that happened, and thank goodness I didn't have to endure that. One quick question, and then moving on. Not to imply that anything like this actually happened, but what, being in the UFO field and having had alien abductions myself, and having discussions with many other alien abductees, it's not uncommon for someone to look up, observe a UFO coming close to them, and then the next memory they have is the UFO flying away. But in the interim, there was quote unquote what they call missing time. Did there seem to be any kind of confusion, dislocation, fugue state set in after that cylindrical craft had flown away, or did it just seem like a seamless transition that nothing had happened?
It seemed like it was seamless and nothing happened except for it's over my head. I mean, literally close my eyes. Oh, it's over here. Well, how to get from here to here? I mean, I've got such an acute memory. That's the other thing. When you read my book, I explain a couple of things about me. I'm kind of a freak of nature. I mean, I remember basically from day one, from 4 years old on, I can remember great, great details about my life, which isn't always good. Obviously being a combat veteran and stuff, and I have a hard time forgetting stuff. My daughter, as a matter of fact, she'll go, "Hey, Dad, can you do me a favor? Can you roll a video in your head? And do you remember when we did this and that?" And I'll be like, "Oh yeah, I remember when we went and visited. We were over in China. I lived over there for a while." She'll have a question about a place we visited. I'll be able to tell who was wearing what. I mean, just weird stuff like that. But so me not remembering that craft being over my head and moving over a few degrees to my right, that's always bugged me. And I did go talk to somebody that was UFO friendly. Peter Robinson turned me on to him, and he was in San Diego. I was living up in Huntington Beach at the time, and I went down and talked to him, and he was kind of flabbergasted that I was even I had a family and kids and stuff, and I was functional after, we had a discussion. He goes, yeah, anyways, he thought it was interesting that I was actually a functional human being. Just I think maybe because of the mercenary stuff we had talked about and some of the things we had talked about there. I had talked to them about, okay, well, all the other guys or a lot of the other guys have had this regressive, hypnotherapy. Should I do that, and kind of resolve this? Because I was having some real anger issues at the time, and I was having a hard time adjusting to civilian life, really. And that took years to finally kind of get normalized. And he brought up a good point. He said, "I could do that." He said, "And we could dig deep, and it'll take a while." But he said, "You're functioning, and everything seems okay, other than you get a bit of problem with anger every now and then." He said, "Do you really want to open up this can of worms and get into that?" And I thought, "Nah, I got a wife and kids and a job, and it's a good job, and nah, things are going pretty good. Maybe I don't want to open that up." So I never really explored it anymore after that, other than one time with Linda Moulton Howe. I tried to go under there, but I don't know, I just wasn't comfortable, and I don't think I really nothing really happened there. So
Yeah, that happened to me a couple of times where I was, allegedly put under, but nothing new came up. And what had happened in the first instance is it somewhat jarred my subconscious, so a previously unremembered experience popped up later. And I think that was a direct result of the what I thought was a failed regression. at first.
Oh,
So yeah,
okay.
I only bring it up because I've heard similar things before, not to imply that he had an abduction at that time, but from others where craft approaches and then it leaves, but there was an intervening loss of time, 5, 10, 12, 20 minutes, whatever the case may be. And the fact that you've got such a retentive memory, and then one moment it's there, the next it's there, yeah, something may have happened, but it's all
Yeah.
conjectural at this point. And I agree with you with your decision, because if you'd already integrated all that stuff, it is a can of worms, because sometimes when people go under it and something does come out, it can be quite shattering.
Well, yeah, apparently, if you go look at John Burroughs, his the tape of him going under, it's pretty disturbing.
I never
So,
listened to that. I mean,
well,
if it's
you might
out
want to
there,
go.
could you tell me
Yeah,
about
it's
it? Like, what came up?
all I know is when I was talking with Linda, she said, sometimes these things get pretty pretty deep and pretty emotional, anticipation that I was actually going to be put under successfully. And she said when John went under, she goes, he had a rough time. He was real emotional. He was yelling and moving around quite a bit and fighting, and it was not a pleasant situation, I guess. So I've never seen the tape. I know when I talked with John, he just kind of, we kind of glossed over it. I don't know if he was embarrassed or what, but he said it. He remembers it being pretty rough. But yeah, I don't know exactly. And that's the whole thing was, I never got into this whole UFO thing. I went on with my life, and I was a professional soldier for years, and I worked with all sorts of unsavory characters, and finally got my life together. And had a family and a career and everything, and I never gave it much thought. I tried to forget about it as much as possible. And then Georgina Bruni, or Brunei, I don't know how you pronounce her name correctly. She wrote the book "You Can't Tell the People," and when she called to interview me, that kind of opened everything up again. And it seemed like ufology and grays and aliens were a little more popular in, the turn of the century than they were back in the 80s. I got pretty ostracized if you talk about UFOs and I saw something. It was, you get the tinfoil hat stigma. So I just went on with my life and never really thought much of it. So I don't know all these players, who's who, what's what, and I just never really got into the whole subject. I'm still not well versed on what's going on in the whole UFO community. It seems like there's a lot of infighting and a lot of people using people, so I just kind of stayed out of it. So.
Yeah, Larry made the famous comment that ufology is the Beirut of the paranormal, implying that there's all these factions, egos, and empires. And he's absolutely right. And he also
Yeah.
said that ufology is it's his worst enemy. And he's absolutely right about that. Now,
Well,
after, oh, please continue.
I was going to say, it's interesting. I don't go. I spoke one time at this event in my hometown just to kind of explain why I got booted out of the Air Force and everything. Because my father was a cop, and my whole family. I mean, I got uncles that were on Omaha Beach and all this stuff. A bunch of war heroes, and I can't make it a year in the Air Force. It wasn't even the Marines; it was the Air Force, for God's sakes. So I just wanted to explain what was going on, even though most of those people had passed and everything, and it had been, whatever, 30-something years. I still felt like I needed to get up and explain to my community, what happened, kind of save my family name a little bit, maybe. But other than that, and a couple other things, I'm just not comfortable going to those conferences, because it seems like you've got some people that are actually really serious researchers and want to know what's going on, and then you've got the circus crowd, and then you got the full-on crazy crowd, and I just don't do well with any of that. If it's a real, like Paula Harris, she's the one that helped me get this book together and do some editing and whatnot. And actually, if it wasn't for her encouraging me, I don't know if I'd have finished it. But she's an actual researcher. She looks at stuff, she asks questions like an investigative journalist should, and lets you come to your own conclusions. She never says it's this, it's that. She lets you figure it out on your own, which is, I think, what you should do, So there's some serious people out there in the UFO community, but yeah, I mean, there's, yeah, definitely our own worst enemy, when it comes to the subject.
It attracts a motley crew, that's for sure. And I've
Yeah.
always taken a more, logical look at things, combined with the intuitive, because we are intuitive psychic beings to some degree, but when you come across these people and they really have belief systems that center around them being this highfalutin contactee, and they're a Palladian hybrid walk-in, and you hear all these stories come out of them. It's you look around for the exit, you know what I mean? And that's what I confronted when I was dealing with this, because so much of what I had experienced was not what was being described by all these new age la-di-das, right? Because I had some degree of trauma and I went through some degree of harassment. There was nothing spiritually uplifting about my experience. Whatever spiritual upliftment
Oh,
I
it
attained
really.
was what I came up with. It wasn't what the aliens did for me, you know what I mean?
Oh, it blew my belief system right out of the water. I went from a good Catholic boy to being in love with death. I mean, for lack of a better term, I mean, I just went off the rails, you know? So, yeah, nothing I'm proud of, you know? I just figured, you know, when I stopped doing that and I became a Christian in 1987, and when I stopped being that type of a person, I was just like, wow, talk about wasted years and wasted youth. What a man. You know, it was, I just looked back at myself like, what an idiot for being so smart. You sure kind of blew your youth, you know? So,
It could happen to the best of us. Now,
oh,
after
yeah.
Georgina Bruni had gotten a hold of you, and I interviewed Georgina years ago, and at that point, did she make a point of connecting you with other Rendlesham RAF Bette Waters veterans?
No, I asked about Larry because I had lost touch with Larry years earlier. Like right after Bentwaters, I met him for probably 2 or 3 years after that because I was going down south and I'd have to go through Connecticut where he was living. So I'd stop in and say hey, and then I'd go do some training. Or if I was going to go do a mission, I'd usually go down to Georgia or Alabama and we'd leave from there. So I'd always swing by and pass him and say hey. If I was on my way back, I'd usually stop by. We'd end up with a night of drinking. But other than Larry, I never really got in touch with anybody. And like I said, after 2 or 3 years, I went my way, he went his. And it wasn't until Georgina got me in touch with him. And then when Georgina initially got in touch with me, I said, you know, I don't even know what I'm supposed to say and not say because I had no clue about anything, you know. And she said, well, Colonel Halt has already talked with me about this. And I said, okay. I said, well, if you give me Colonel Halt's phone number and I call Colonel Halt and he says I can talk to you, I'll give you a call back and I'll talk to you. But I said, I'm not doing anything until I talk to somebody above my pay grade, you know? So I called him up and he said, yeah. He goes, I remember you. I remember that night. Yep, sure thing. I said, well, what am I supposed to say and not say? And he said, you know, that's the funny thing. He said, you can say whatever you want. Nobody seems to care. I said, all right. He said, just be honest. And I said, all right, that's easy. So she got back in touch with me and I told her my side of the story and what I saw and what I witnessed and kind of the disposition of the officers that night. And yeah, and that was it. And I never contacted anybody after that. I don't even remember how I got in touch with John Burroughs. I don't know if maybe Larry gave me his phone number or I looked him up on Facebook one time, something like that. But he and I had met one time and we kind of talked about things because when I got arrested that night after my fake suicide attempt there, John was actually one of the police officers that arrested me. So we had a little laugh and a little talk about that because I get away from him. I assaulted a police officer that night and got away from John, and then the officers assaulted me. It's a pretty interesting night, but I got what I deserved. Let's put it that way.
Well, I imagine having that shared background with the sightings and all the skullduggery and spook activity that went on, that at some level John could sympathize, getting the backstory of, did he know why you did the attempted
No,
suicide attempt?
that night we didn't even know each other were involved at all. I didn't even know who John Burroughs was until years later. Oh, John Burroughs. And he said, yeah, I'm the one that arrested you. You got me in trouble because somebody saw them. What happened was I ran, I gave up because nobody could catch me because I used to be a long distance runner. So I was running all over the base and they couldn't catch me. So I finally gave up because that was the goal, was to give up and be caught and get out of the service. So I gave up. They grabbed me. One of the guys went to get the vehicle. I elbowed John like in the chest because he was tall. I had to really elbow him up, and I was able to break free. I ran again, and then I just kind of laughed in their face, and then they jumped me. So they were a little rough with me, and somebody saw that and turned him in for police brutality type, thing. And I think when I was questioned on it, I just told them, "Hey, man, I got what I deserved. It's not their fault. I
Well,
was an
that's
asshole."
kind of ironic because to the outside observer, the eyewitness who turned them in, it's they just see a dog pile taking place and some poor guy at the bottom getting pummeled, but they don't know the backstory, UFOs and attempted suicide and stuff.
They don't know anything what's going on, and they didn't pummel me hard. They were just, it was kind of rough, but I was fighting back. I mean, I got my ass kicked because I deserved to get my ass kicked. I was fighting the cops. What do you don't do that. So, but anyway, so I got my weapons cards taken away right away, and I never went back online after that. I was never a cop again after that. So, I mean, after that, I still didn't do anything. I think the next time I had any involvement with the UFO thing was when Paulino and his son got in touch with me about some sort of a Bentwaters Rendlesham Forest reunion, and there was three or four of us on the phone talking at the same time. But I was already living in China then, so we did it on Skype, and we did a couple of Sundays, I guess, a couple sessions, and. Yeah, then the next thing was when I did that talk in Leominster in Massachusetts, in my hometown. So, like I said, I haven't really been involved with this whole subject. I got a life, I got things I was doing. I was working in the oil refinery industry doing construction projects, and I was into project management. So, yeah.
Well,
I didn't make ufology my life career or anything. Not disrespecting anybody that did, but it's. Yeah, I never intended, and I always said through the years, I have no ambition to write a book or do anything like that. And the only reason I wrote the book was I thought, people are saying Larry wasn't even in the Air Force, and me and Larry have had our ups and downs through the years, okay? But we resolved that because we're men and we can get over ourselves, right? And and it was the 80s and everybody was all partying and stuff. So how do you hold anybody accountable when you're not even in your right mind, right? So, so Larry and I, we patched our differences up. But when people are saying, well, Larry wasn't even on base, he wasn't even in the Air Force, he didn't make it through basic training, I'm thinking, no, man, that's just stupid, And I'm not on anybody's side. Everybody's got their sides on this and everything. I try to stay neutral, but I'm not going to have somebody say Larry wasn't there when I know damn well he was. I talked to the man on base and I've seen him on duty in his uniform. I mean, it's just stupid, some of the naysayers and the negative people out there. But whatever. I mean, everybody's got their own agenda, I guess. So I wanted to set the record straight. That's why I dedicated a whole chapter to Larry. Chapter 6 is Larry's, because I wanted to everybody to know what he told me when he came in a week or so after my sighting. So that was the freshest account that he ever gave me. It was the first account he gave me. It was the most freshest account. I remember it very vividly, except at one spot my mind was kind of wandering. So I was just thinking, wow, what did I get myself into here? Holy mackerel, And but after that, it was just time to get out of there as far as I was concerned. And like I said, I was an immature kid back then. I can only blame so much on immaturity. I made my own path and I ran on it. So,
Well, talk about being thrown into the deep end, and Larry in a similar boat because he was pretty much a young kid too. Both of
yeah,
you
he was
hadn't been,
19 and I was 18.
yeah, and both of you hadn't been on the base that long for all that stuff to happen, and then the aftermath. But Larry, you vividly remember Larry talking about the kidnapping of him, hauled into the vehicle, winding up underground, drugged, all that stuff. Wow, yeah.
He was talking about that. He was talking about how they said, you can go talk about it, just remember bullets are cheap. I mean that's a direct threat to your life,
Yeah.
so yeah, at that point I was just like, all right, I don't know what I got into. this base sucks anyways. I just want to get out of here. And I, like I said, just in a drunken stupor, had a thought of, I'm just going to fake a suicide attempt and get the hell out of here. So that's what I did. So I'm not real proud of it, but that's what I
Well,
did. I trashed my career. I mean, the Air Force didn't trash it. I trashed it myself just as a self-preservation move. So.
you had a destiny to fulfill, and clearly it didn't involve being in the Air Force anymore, especially in light of what you experienced as a merc in all the years afterwards. Now,
Yeah.
not to ascribe any blame to Larry or anyone else, but do you think it's possible that since Larry was under observation at that base, that the fact that you two were having a powwow and he's telling you this stuff, that at that point you went on their spook radar, or you were on the spook radar the moment you Palmer made the report?
Well, I don't know. I would say if you look at it from a point of view of like an intel community, if the intel community was really that involved in everything, then they were probably listening to my phone calls back to my mom and dad going, hey, I got involved with something here. I don't know what it is, but I got to get out of here. I mean, they probably picked up on that. They probably figured I was a bad apple, was going to say something. I don't know. But I definitely had people tailing me. So somebody somehow, and whether it was a result of Larry or whether it was a result of me saying something and getting out of there, whether it was a result of me doing this fake suicide attempt to try and get out of there, I have no idea. But I do know this. After our sighting, the airman that was with me, Airman Palmer, ended up getting sucked into the Air Force OSI.
Oh,
And I
really?
got a phone. Yeah, like within weeks.
You mean
And
he
I got
was
a phone.
recruited by them, or he was harassed by them?
No, he was recruited by them. He was Air Force OSI very soon after.
The
So
plot
I've always
thickens.
wondered, yeah, I've always wondered it, you know, I mean, I could come up with 100 different things of what I saw over my head. Was it a UFO? Was it a blimp? Was it a drone? Was it a hologram? Did they spray me with LSD and give me suggestions? So, I mean, it could have been a million things. To this day, I have no idea what I saw. All I know is I believe I saw a structured craft over my head and I'm going to
Yeah.
die saying it. So, you know.
And what if it was painted by radar when it was above you? So
Yeah.
somebody had known that, hey, there's something going on over here, right?
Yeah.
And what if it was
Yeah, I
observed
mean,
and painted at the same time?
how can I be on a NATO base and a craft be, I mean, literally 1,000 feet or less off the deck above my head and nobody else saw it but me and Palmer? And there's a whole base. I mean, this is a NATO base. I mean, this is a tactical base. I mean, there's somebody in the tower. How come
Yeah.
he didn't see it? You know, I mean, I don't know. There's so many questions with that. I have no idea. You know, was it cloaked? Could only we see it? Was it like dimensional and we could only see it because we were underneath it? There's so many questions I have that I know will never get answered, and I'm fine with that now at this point in my life because, yeah.
Well,
So.
one thing that I've learned in my time having had experiences, but also doing the research and networking with my own crowd, is I've always viewed the UFO community as an enemy strong point to be avoided at all costs, right? I only would go to conferences and lectures at, back in the day to meet other people like me. It wasn't necessarily to see the speakers, although some of the speakers I wanted to see, but generally it was just to, find others like myself. Because it was, to me, it was always a fractious, divisive enemy strong point, and I just did my darndest to avoid it at all costs. So you did yourself a good service by doing the same. And one thing I'd like to point out, before we end this first segment, and thank you for sharing, it's been very eye-opening for me, is there's the military veterans, whether someone saw combat or not, and then what I call the cosmic veterans, which one does not have to have been in the military to be a cosmic veteran, because I mean, I was a sand crab. I was a civilian working for the Navy, but I was still a civilian even though I came from a Navy family. But the commonality that you and I and others share is that we're cosmic veterans, that whatever is out there under the ground, whatever, for whatever reason, had decided they had a vested interest in us at a certain point in time, right? And so when we have that shared kind of experience, I don't say this in an elitist sense, but it does tend to kind of make you feel a little different from the rest of the crowd because of that shared trauma, that shared experience. So thank you
And
for sharing.
it yeah, and you know, and that kind of raises a couple questions too of why me? I think everybody's probably why this happened to me. I liked the Air Force. So I didn't want my career to end. I was genuinely happy there. I like being in a regulated, situation. So there's that question, and the other one is, okay, well, if it is me, what purpose? If I was abducted. I have no clue if I was, but if I was, then was it for their gain? Did they do something to me so I can better mankind or what? I don't know. Because I don't think anything positive came out of that for the next decade or so. So.
That was one of the questions I asked myself. It's like, why little old me? It's like there's billions of people on this planet. Why did they single me out? That was like something that always just befuddled me, right? So, anyhow, if you have any more comments to make before we end this first segment, it's been
Okay.
very interesting and enlightening.
Okay. No, I don't have any other comments other than I'm going to be getting a YouTube channel up here pretty quick, which has nothing to do with ufology. I've got a farm. It's called Peaceful Acres, and it's going to be me building a roundhouse and building my farm up. So it's got nothing to do with that. But
Oh,
if
good.
anybody's interested in sustainable living,
Oh, I'm all into that.
I'm out in
Definitely.
Kentucky and I'm off grid. I have no cell service where I'm at. I'm out in the middle of nowhere. So just trying to do that. And it's kind of a goal of mine to be 100% self-sustainable off grid. So I'm working on that. So.
Also, go ahead and plug your book. And like I said, it's en route. I haven't got it yet, but I'm definitely going to read it.
Okay. Yeah. Is Rendlesham to Redemption a Story of Transformation? And it's available on Amazon. You can go to Amazon Books and pick it up there. And you can either get a hard copy or you can get it in Kindle, either or, whatever your preference is. So.
And to our dear listeners and viewers out there, if you like what we do, if you believe what we do, please go to thecosmicswitchboard.com, sign up and become a member, and we'll see you at the top of the next segment.